Following are some comments on William Shakespeare's Pericles, Prince of Tyre, Act 1. If Jove stray, who dares say Jove doth ill? Pericles, hoping to win for himself King Antiochus's beautiful daughter, discovers the king's incestuous scandal and flees. In Act 1, Scene 1, the play's action opens with Prince Pericles having just arrived in Antioch to take his chances with the king's guilty riddle, marriage to the king's beautiful daughter being the prize. Antiochus offers what sounds like the ancient version of a legal disclaimer regarding the trial Pericles is about to undergo. The young man is quite the romance hero at this point, all on fire to risk his life for supreme beauty and eros. Antiochus's arrogance shows immediately when he refers to his daughter as fit for, quote-unquote, the embracements even of Jove himself. Act 1, Scene 1, Line 8. Is he really comparing himself to Zeus, i.e. to Jove, who married his own sister Hera? In any case, the young lady is characterized as a wondrous, perfect work of nature. The girl is also likened to the Hesperides, who lived in a garden filled with golden apples. Again, her beauty is supreme, but dangerous and forbidden. Almost everything either Pericles or Antiochus says about her testifies to this forbidden quality. The myth of the Hesperides is that they were tasked with guarding the golden apples in the gardens commemorating the marriage of Zeus and Hera. A dragon kept the Hesperides themselves from stealing the apples, but one such piece of fruit ends up at the destructive scene of the judgment of Paris. The goddess Strife, called Eris, E-R-I-S, in Greek, made one of these apples the prize for judging which of three goddesses was the most beautiful, Hera, Athena, or Aphrodite. The outcome of that contest was the Trojan War. See theoi.com, spelled T-H-E-O-I, for further information on the legend of the Hesperides. In any case, Antiochus's daughter is, according to him, quite irresistible. I think we may take as projection both this assertion and the attribution of haughtiness or arrogance to Pericles and the fellow princes who have sought her favors. Pericles professes to take Antiochus's warnings to heart and declares himself, quote-unquote, ready for the way of life or death. Act 1, Scene 1, Line 55. Antiochus seems angry that yet another young challenger has insisted upon competing with him for his daughter's love. In this regard, he is a typical Freudian jealous father. The daughter declares that of all the men who have sought marriage to her, she wishes most of all that he should succeed. Perhaps it's cynical to say so, but it's difficult to avoid thinking that Antiochus's daughter says this to all the applicants. There is something ritualistic about the pronouncement. She must be used to this rigmarole by now. Should we suppose that she is desperate to escape the clutches of her wicked father? It's impossible to say, but we're told by Gower that over time, habit took hold and neither party to the sin felt the sting of conscience. As for the riddle itself, part of it leads directly to the supposedly life-preserving answer, and part is confusing or muddled. We can see how Antiochus makes his daughter his wife and himself her husband, but how does the king become her son and she his mother? Perhaps a Freudian framework will be of service here. In rejecting his daughter as a daughter, we might say, Antiochus deranges the temporal scheme of his relationship and opens the door to the family secret that the male child desires his mother first of all. In this sense, every woman he sleeps with is his mother, just as every man the daughter sleeps with is symbolically her father. The glaringly obvious part of the riddle remains unspoken to the king's face. The directness of the riddle's challenge is a power play on Antiochus's part. Like a typical bully, he tosses out damning information and double dares anyone to make it plain in his angry, forbidding presence. When bullies tell obvious lies to their hearers, they are really saying, "Come now, we both know I'm lying. The question is, what are you going to do about it? I hold you in complete contempt, so I'm betting you're too afraid of me to act on what you know." There's a mise-en-abîme quality to this operation. Since none of Pericles' predecessor knights answered the riddle correctly, we may assume that even if they did figure it out, they blinked, just as Pericles himself now does. He knows the answer, but it's taboo to blurt it out. Either way, he's at grave risk of losing the life that he has already declared himself ready to lose. The Freudian interdiction is at work here, a dark, unsettling truth that may be glimpsed in distorted or screened form, but never revealed in its simplicity without shattering consequences. With regard to the political theory dimension that we find in many of Shakespeare's plays, Antiochus's sexual secret may parallel a secret regarding governance and authority, one not unrelated to the Platonic dilemma of rulership. He carries a guilty knowledge of human nature and of the realities involved in keeping control of his realm. Antiochus is daring subjects and foreigners alike to make this knowledge common, knowing that their terror will keep them from revealing the taboo. The riddle, then, aside from its incestuous dimension, involves the nature of political authority and the capacity to govern. I would remind us of Aeschylus's carefully articulated renaming and relegation in the Oresteia of the vengeful Furies to the Eumenides, or well-abiding, well-attending, or perhaps even they who bide their time. The Furies don't simply go away. They remain as something like guarantors of the civic and legal order of Athens. There is also the scandalous truth in Plato's Republic, Book 3, passage 389b through c, that it is acceptable for rulers to lie to their subjects so long as the purpose of the lie is governance itself, the maintenance of order. Pericles, upon solving the riddle, is immediately put off at the thought of romance with the king's daughter. He sees her as a, quote-unquote, glorious casket stored with ill. Act 1, Scene 1, Line 78. Antiochus demands an answer, forbidding Pericles to touch his daughter at this point. Pericles addresses the king directly and seems to say enough to anger him. Pericles shrinks back in fear from doing more than hinting that he knows the true secret the king hides. Essentially, he declares that he knows the truth but will not make it manifest. It is bold enough that he should say, quote unquote, "And if Jove stray, who dares say Jove doth ill?" Act 1, Scene 1, Line 105. But Pericles will not speak the word incest. He will not reveal the scandal itself, but his boldness consists in a species of counter-bullying whereby he makes the king understand that he knows the secret. Pericles himself is a ruler, and is, at least in that, the equal of Antiochus. Antiochus doesn't quite know what to do with this bold foreigner, and offers him 40 days of delay, time in which he might yet reveal the secret. Pericles seems to be averse to doing that, but in any case, Antiochus surely has no intention of keeping his word. The king decides to temporize and dissemble by means of decorous entertainment until he finds a convenient opportunity to do away with his young rival. Pericles sees through this false politeness and decides to flee from Antioch. He characterizes what the daughter is doing as being like the action of a serpent, quote unquote, an eater of her mother's flesh, with the daughter cannibalizing and replacing the mother. Act 1, Scene 1, Line 131. It may be, too, that in replacing the mother in this destructive way, the daughter thus abused destroys the mother principle itself. And since this principle must function together with the patrilineal principle that guarantees the male sovereign's futurity and royal line, Antiochus's corruption of his daughter turns her into the means whereby his own political dynasty, his futurity, is destroyed. It is a justly humiliating way for an exalted man to find out that he is not immortal after all. How right Pericles is about Antiochus's devious intentions we see immediately when the king, like the stage villain he is, tells us he plans to kill Pericles as soon as possible and summons his chamberlain, Thaliart. This man is so obedient to the king that he even plans to use a pistol to do the job, an invention still far in the future. Evidently, George Wilkins, who seems to have written the first couple of acts of the play, shares Shakespeare's penchant for anachronisms. As Thomas Love Peacock writes in his satirical essay, The Four Ages of Poetry, the Elizabethans, quote-unquote, made no scruple of deposing a Roman emperor by an Italian count and sending him off in the disguise of a French pilgrim to be shot with a blunderbuss by an English archer. So why not give an ancient assassin a pistol? They do abuse the king that flatter him. Back in Tyre, Helicanus gives the anxious Pericles sound advice. Be patient and travel. At the beginning of Act 1, Scene 2, Pericles explains how his anxiety about the threat posed by Antiochus grew upon him, until at last it now seems he must do something to relieve it. Pericles understands the logic and realities of power. Princes who fail to pass Machiavelli 101 seldom last long in Shakespeare's works. Antiochus has every intention of making good on his threat to eliminate the one man who could reveal his guilty secret. The prince also reveals to us that his seeming near paranoia about the punitive reach of Antiochus is really about the welfare of his subjects, not a dread selfishly felt for his own safety alone. Pericles demands honesty from Helicanus, who disclaims all pretense of flattery. He tells the prince that flattery is the last thing he needs and implies that his disturbed state threatens both his own welfare and that of the kingdom. Helicanus says confidently, quote-unquote, they do abuse the king that flatter him. Act 1, Scene 2, line 38. Pericles is impressed and agrees with the sentiment expressed. The conversation between Helicanus and Pericles reveals an interesting contrast from the court of Antiochus, where Pericles offered himself counsel of a more Machiavellian nature. That advice was entirely appropriate due to the quality of Antiochus's court, which was unhealthy, even deranged. Pericles's realm, by contrast, is ordered properly, with Pericles, a true prince, and Helicanus, a loyal, capable subject who treats his prince with reverence and honesty. Helicanus now shifts his counsel from advocating patience to advocating travel. Pericles decides that he will go to Tarsus, which we might observe with the Norton editors is St. Paul's city of birth. While the play is set in pre-Christian times, the place probably still indicates to Shakespeare's audience that Pericles the traveler is about to undergo a spiritual transformation under the pressure of harsh experience. At this point, the reference works at a general level of significance. If a king bid a man be a villain, Antiochus's henchman, Thaliart, plays Tyre a visit, only to find that Pericles has sailed away by now. Act 1, Scene 3 is very brief, but it introduces us to Thaliart, who seems like a capable rascal, even if this play offers him no hope of developing into an irrepressible Iago. Thaliart says matter-of-factly, quote-unquote, if a king bid a man be a villain, he's bound by the indenture of his oath to be one. Act 1, Scene 3, lines 6 through 7. This statement admirably captures the ethical trap constituted by corrupt courts everywhere. Thaliart seems like a standard Machiavellian operator. He keeps his eyes and ears open and rolls with the punches. At Tyre, he at least gets enough information to spin a narrative for Antiochus that might keep an enterprising servant out of trouble. Helicanus easily discerns why this chamberlain has really traveled to Tyre, but he keeps up the appearance of civility. Your grace is welcome to our town and us. Governor Cleon of famine-stricken Tarsus greets Pericles arriving with his fleet. It's worth noting with a look forward that Pericles, when met with terrible misfortunes, falls silent, but here in Act 1, Scene 4, Governor Cleon of Tarsus expresses to his wife Dionysa a strong faith in the therapeutic power of lamentation. Tarsus, it seems, was once a wealthy, prideful city that disdained the very thought of ever needing assistance. Its citizens, suggests Cleon, were more concerned with fashion and the competitive delights of what today we might call conspicuous consumption than with anything like mere utility and sufficiency. But those days are gone, and all he can do is hope the advancing fleet means the city no harm. Famine has made even him, Tarsus's governor, altogether desperate. Quote unquote, "Bring they what they will and what they can, what need we fear?" Act 1, Scene 4, lines 75 through 76. Pericles sets Cleon's mind at ease, telling him that Tarsus's suffering has been known for a while, even as far as Tyre. "There is no Greek assault on Troy," says Pericles, "but a mission of mercy. He has brought grain to fortify the starving people of Tarsus, and asks only, quote unquote, for love and harborage for ourself, our ships, and men." Act 1, Scene 4, lines 98 through 99. Cleon offers both, even calling down a curse on himself and his city if Pericles should ever find they've broken their bond. And he says, ingratiatingly, quote unquote, "Your grace is welcome to our town and us." Act 1, Scene 4, line 105. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Sunday, June 1st, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.